Welcome to the Teach the Geek podcast, where engineer and author Neil Thompson talks with STEM professionals about public speaking, a struggle for many of us. Whether you're a novice public speaker or a proficient one, you can always pick up tips on how to improve. Here's your host, Neil Thompson.
Welcome to another edition of Teach the Geek Interviews. My name is Neil Thompson. I'm the founder of Teach the Geek. I work with technical professionals so they can present more effectively, especially in front of non-technical audiences. And you can learn more about that at teachthegeek.com. Again, that's teachthegeek.com. If you are watching this on YouTube, a like and a subscribe would be great. And if you're listening to the podcast, well, a like and subscribe would be good there too. So today, my guest is Angelo Collins. He's Executive Director of the Vertical Flight Society. So what is the Vertical Flight Society? What does one do to prepare to be Executive Director of the Vertical Flight Society? What about the Horizontal Flight Society? So many questions. So let's get to it. Welcome to Teach the Geek Interviews, Angelo.
Thanks for having me.
So from the bit of research I did on you, I saw that you got a degree in aerospace engineering. So what was the motivation to get that degree?
Oh, boy. So I'll give you the real answer. So I went to the University of Maryland, studied aerospace. At the time, I was living in Massachusetts. That's where I'd grown up. And I was trying to decide what to do. I was even thinking about becoming a priest my senior year. I'm Greek Orthodox, and I toured even the seminary. It's there in Boston. And I was like, yeah, you know what? I'm really good at math, and I like to problem solve. And so maybe engineering is for me. And so I looked at the different engineering disciplines, and it's surprisingly broad. If you want to be an engineer, it's fascinating how many different disciplines there are. And if you meet somebody and they're also an engineer and you find out like, oh, I'm a chemical engineer or I'm a civil engineer. It's like, all right, we don't have anything in common. I don't know what to talk to you about. But there's some of the fundamentals. Aerospace is one discipline that's fairly broad, and it does cover different things, whether it be structures that might touch on civil and electrical, avionics, and obviously aerodynamics. And an aerospace degree touches on aerodynamics a bit. But why I was interested, aerospace tends to be seen as a challenging major. And it's surprising a lot of the kids that I studied with, you know, did they have a passion for aviation? Maybe not. They just enjoyed the challenge, and aviation is just a fun discipline to be in. And so a lot of my friends and classmates just studied aerospace in part because they were looking for a challenge and they had a strong math background. And maybe to those listening, you know, you don't necessarily need to have a passion, and you live and eat and breathe, you know, your discipline that you want to study, but finding something that has, you know, there's work and it's a good job and you have some interest in the discipline, you know, it aerospace could be, you know, up your alley. And that was me initially. And I've certainly grown to love aviation, and especially vertical flight, which is what made me end up at the Vertical Flight Society.
You know, Angelo, your talk about passion made me think about garbage collectors. Are they passionate about collecting garbage? Probably not, but I'm guessing it's a pretty good paying job. It's pretty steady. I highly doubt there's going to be a whole lot of layoff when it comes to that kind of job, because we have to get our garbage picked up no matter what. It probably was one of those essential jobs during the pandemic. So they know they were going to be working. They weren't going to be furloughed. And so when it comes to, I guess, passion, I hear a lot of people when they talk about what you should do with your life, it's follow your passion. And it always made me think about the garbage collectors and just the people that do those kind of jobs where you think that this is not really what they probably thought they were going to be doing when they were a little kid, but it's not as if they regret doing what they're doing now, because I'm sure they're supporting their families with it, and it's a good paying job, and that's what they're looking for.
I think everyone has maybe a passion, or they should strive to find a passion in their life at some point. It doesn't need to be when you're 18 years old, because I remember not knowing what I wanted to do. I wanted someone to tell me what to do at that point. But it's good to strive to find a passion, and your passions don't necessarily need to be in a specific discipline, technical discipline. It could be simply just wanting to work with people and help people. And that was a part of maybe my drive and thinking about becoming a priest, was I just wanted to be able to help people. And I found ways to do that even in this aerospace discipline. And now I'm here at a nonprofit. And, part of my role here is to just try to find opportunities to help, the vertical flight domain and our community within this domain, help it grow, give out scholarships to the kids at the universities, and just help foster and celebrate our members. And that's been a passion for me. So that's so th you know I, could I be doing could I be working garbage? Maybe. But if as long as I felt like I had a purpose and I was helping people, sure. But aviation's fun.
Nice. Also from some research I did on you, I saw that you studied engineering administration. I've never heard of that. So what is engineering administration and what made you decide to study that?
So I could go on forever about this topic. Let me start with so yeah, I studied at Virginia Tech for that degree, and that was my master's degree. Similar to so when you consider studying aerospace engineering, I think when you're 18 years old, you're like, oh yeah, I'm gonna build an aircraft. And it's like, well, maybe. It depends where you work and who you work for. And there's a lot to engineering as a whole, and everyone has their different role and they wear their different hats. Surprisingly, like when you talk about, let's say, the F-35, an F-35B hovers, it's a V-stall aircraft, so we can talk about the F-35. At Lockheed Martin is the prime contractor, right? They manage the final assembly and they manage the F-35 aircraft as a whole. Now, there's thousands of different vendors, and the supply chain is substantial. And when you're talking about getting hands-on as an engineer and actually building something, it's typically those guys, smaller companies, they're the ones kind of tinkering and building things. And then those subsystems become consolidated and assembled together to build what is the F-35. And so when you're talking about engineering administration, it's looking at the big picture of managing all of that and understanding the engineering as an enterprise. Understanding all the different pieces, learning and learning how to manage engineers. It's a little different. And there's different ladders that engineers can climb. You could become a chief engineer one day, managing the technical side of things. But you could also climb the management rungs of the ladder. And there's more rungs in the management side. And so those are decisions that all engineers actually need to make in their career at a certain point. Like, am I going to become a manager? Am I going to become like a chief technical officer, a chief engineer? And that discipline helped me learn, or that major helped me learn a little bit more about the business of engineering. And it's certainly applicable in my role now as managing a society of engineers. And so it was a great major. And so yeah, I'm glad I studied that.
Nice. Yeah. When I first saw it, I just thought, oh, engineering administration, what does that mean? Is it the same as engineering management? I mean, but yeah, it was great that you learn something new every day. So I'm really happy about that. So when it comes to the work that you did before you were the executive director of the Vertical Flight Society, what type of jobs did you have?
So I started my career. I got an internship, and I'll never forget. Truly appreciative of my advisor at the University of Maryland, Daryl Pines. Now he's the president of the University of Maryland system. He helped me get an internship, and it was an internship supporting DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. And I spent most of my tenure supporting DARPA. They do high risk, high payoff research type work. In my role in supporting DARPA, I served more as support to the government and the government program managers that manage the funds that are distributed to the companies doing the work. And we wore a lot of different hats. And many times there was technical aspects of the job where we're reviewing deliverables submitted by these companies, different milestones, their critical design review documentation, PDR, all the different milestones, and having that technical background was helpful. Source selection as well, when you're trying to decide who to give the money to and reviewing their proposals. But in addition to that, there's a lot of red tape associated with working at DARPA and the different types of documents and MOAs and CRADAs. And so we also help draft those and handle those. And I support it in a similar capacity at the Office of Naval Research. Both of these are in Arlington, Virginia. And I also worked on the F-35 in their program office. And so that was, and again, a similar type of role. So most of my career had been in R&D, and working with others and working well with others. So that's some of my background before I started here at the Vertical Flight Society.
What prompted you to actually become the executive director of the Vertical Flight Society?
Well, as I said before, I had a passion for helping people, and I truly enjoy one of my passions is meeting new people and learning about them, and just just building a network of folks that I can talk to and help and connect. And I did that in my prior career, and so I thought the position was appealing to be, in some respects, the representative of the vertical flight community, all the engineers and scientists, and being someone that could and had the capacity to help and support and be a beacon to help direct the Vertical Flight Society to grow and expand and become greater than what it is now. And so when the position opened up, like anyone else would do, I submitted a resume. I got some letters of recommendation, and I must have done pretty good in my interview. So they thought maybe they'd give me the opportunity, and I'm thankful for that.
Nice. I probably should have asked this question before, but what is vertical flight? What are you referring to when you talk about vertical flight?
So vertical flight, to not to really dumb it down, but spinning things to generate lift, right? And usually spinning a rotor or blades or propellers. And conventional helicopter is what people think of when they think of vertical flight. But not all aircraft that can take off vertically, land vertically, hover, are helicopters. And so that's why we changed the name back in, I believe, the 2010s. We were originally called the American Helicopter Society International, and then we realized it was probably time to embrace even in our name, vertical flight. And so we're now called the Vertical Flight Society, and we're international. We work with all different companies and members from across the globe. And so yeah, vertical flight is just an is just covering that broad spectrum of aircraft that can't hover, take off vertically, and land vertically.
Okay, are drones included in that?
Yeah, if it's an aircraft that can take off and land vertically, we have different categories. Maybe that'll be helpful. So you have a VTOL aircraft, vertical takeoff and landing, which means it can take off and land vertically. You have VSTOL, right? So for example, the F-35 is a VSTOL, F-35B. So it can't take off vertically, but it can land. And it can land vertically because it weighs less when it because you run out of fuel by that point. Back in the day, the Harrier, for example, would have to dump fuel. Maybe not economically friendly. It would dump fuel to be able to do a vertical landing because it would be too heavy. If it, for example, it needed me to make an emergency landing and land vertically. And so that VSTOL stands for vertical and or short takeoff and landing. There's also stall aircraft, short takeoff and landing, e-stall aircraft, extremely short takeoff and landing, where they don't necessarily need a long runway. Those aren't captured by the Vertical Flight Society necessarily because they do need a short runway to take off and land. But there are some aircraft that are a little hybrid, like gyroplanes or auto gyros. You can technically get them to do a jump takeoff. You spin up the rotor. Gyroplanes are a little different in that the flow of the air is actually coming up through instead of down and being pushed. But if you spin up the rotors before you take off, and then pitch the blades collectively, you can get a jump out of it, and that's technically a vertical takeoff. And if they're landing into the wind, they can maybe potentially land vertically, but that one's a little bit more controversial.
How did your past jobs prepare you to be the executive director of the Vertical Flight Society?
I'd say, back when I was back when I started working, I was absorbing things, and funny how you don't realize when you're hiring a kid out of college, they may not know how to use Outlook. They might not know how to send an invite, a meeting invite, because these kids aren't necessarily, in that mindset and in that role. But I think once you're about maybe 2 to 3 years into your career and you start working for a company and other people, you start to become more comfortable in that type of setting. And that's even when you get to the point where maybe 3 to 5 years into your career, you think, "Oh, I'm hot stuff. I'm pretty awesome. I know what I'm doing. I know everything. I figured this out." And that's not true. It takes time to learn how to work with others in a corporate setting, and knowing what to say, what not to say, how to make people feel comfortable, how to help lead others. There's lots of different roles that I had to help me get to this point where I was able to take on different responsibilities, take on different roles in managing others, even getting to the point where I was tracking the finances for a team and how we were billable, unbillable, whether we were billing, to a customer or to, business and development. And so having a lot of different opportunities to grow, it was good to maybe have a different, not a completely different job once every 2 to 3 years, but doing something a little different every 2 to 3 years. And I remember at the time, the PEO, it's a 3-star general that runs the F-35, had, he was great. This was Matt Winter. And he told us all, like, "I don't want you guys to be here 3 years from now. I want you to do something different. I don't want to see you doing the same job." And that's how you grow in your career. And if you're interested in growing in your career and building up to the point where you could feel comfortable in a role like being the executive director of a nonprofit, it's good to do different things, learn different things, and not feel afraid to try something new. Especially if you think down the road it might have been beneficial that you did take on that responsibility, and not being afraid to take on new responsibilities. So that's I embraced that, and I hit the ground running when I was 22. When I got out of college, I started working in the DoD, contracting and working with adults. And I was always the youngest person, and it was good though for me, and benefited me to kind of, just jump in and just get started on developing myself. So yeah.
Nice. That was really great. That's really great that you got that advice from somebody saying that, every 3 years you really should be looking to do something else, because in so many other places it's quite the opposite. It's okay, you're really good at this, keep doing that. And oftentimes those changes don't even happen in your work life until you agitate for them. You want to do something new, and sometimes it can be an uphill battle to even get that opportunity. So I think that's really cool that you were told that early on. You should be growing into different things, so don't just stay stagnant in one place. That's excellent.
And briefly on that, I'd say it depends. So if you're a company and you have someone that's really good at something, unfortunately, they're not going to be the ones to say, "Hey, you're really good at this one task. How about you start doing a different task and learning a different." In reality, it's the individual that needs to advocate for themselves, and that's great if they're good at something and if they enjoy that. But depending on what they want to get out of their career, it may be beneficial to them. Just because they're good at something doesn't mean they necessarily need to continue to do that, because the company will just let you press on. And if you're making money for them and you're doing a specific task really well, then unfortunately, that's not necessarily promotion material. Like, "Oh, he's really good at that. Let's give him a completely different job and promote him now because he's really good at this one task." And that's just the reality of the corporate world. So those are
Indeed,
things you
100%. So when it comes to you being the executive director, what are your, I guess, your plans for the society? What do you hope to accomplish?
Well, I'm about 4 months in, and we have a board of directors meeting coming up in a month or so. And so I won't cover too much in detail until that point. But we do want to grow the society. We have about 6,500 members, and those are folks that are extremely passionate about vertical flight. And we tend to have a small niche community because the Vertical Flight Society and that this community as a whole is very passionate about vertical flight. And because they could be a part of and put more of their time towards other things, other nonprofits, but for them, vertical flight is a passion. And so we'd like to expand that to those that are even simply interested in learning more about vertical flight. And education doesn't necessarily mean, you're studying vertical flight in college. It could just simply be learning more about the different types of helicopters and aircraft that exist that can fly vertically. We want to give out more scholarships. We have the Vertical Flight Foundation, and we give out about $100,000 in scholarships every year to kids studying vertical flight. And I'd like to try to expand that and grow that fund to get to more kids and provide financial assistance to more kids. They all really appreciate it when they get that ch check. And to be able to give more would be something that I'd really strive to do. And also just doing things more efficiently. We are hosting the headquarters. We have different student chapters and regional chapters, and these different chapters might organize events. The Vertical Flight Society headquarters, we headlined the annual forum, which is a large event, and one of the second largest events now is is our Transformative Vertical Flight event that's coming up in February in Santa Clara, the convention center. And we're looking to grow those events always and provide more value to the attendees. And so ideas there of what we can do. But big picture, just ensure that we are internally healthy. And so, the more healthy we are internally within our society, corporate, the more beneficial will be to our members and the community as a whole.
Got it. Angela, because you said you're going to be meeting with the board or later this year, I suspect you of all people can appreciate the importance of being able to communicate with others as an engineer or otherwise. And when I first started Teach the Geek, this podcast, it really was based on my own struggles giving presentations in front of management and what I did to get better at it, and then hearing from other people like me that come from the technical fields and what they did to get better at it. So when it comes to presenting in front of others or public speaking generally, is that something you've always been good at? And if not, what'd you do to get better at it?
No, absolutely not. It takes practice, and not everyone's a natural. I can remember being a kid, and one of my worst memories was when I was maybe in fourth grade, and we had to present something about. We each got a state that we had to like make a little presentation, and this was back when we were using the transparencies and projecting, and I remember like the memory of me like just blacking out, just being petrified to stand in front of my class in fourth grade. And to talk. But through that, now I'm at a point where I can speak. I spoke at the forum. There may be about 1,000 people in the room, and I didn't even really prepare handwritten script. I just kind of spoke openly. And I felt fine. I wasn't too nervous about it. And so if you're nervous about public speaking, you can certainly grow and build and become a better public speaker. It comes with practice, unfortunately, and if you don't have opportunities, then you should try to find them. Whether that be trying to find a job that maybe allows you to do a little bit more public speaking or presenting to your management, or Toastmasters. I'm sure I haven't personally done, but I've heard good things about. Knowing your subject matter is important when you are talking to others. And if you have a good handle on that, then it does make it a little bit easier. Also preparing, thinking through what you're going to say. You don't necessarily need to. I mean, some people like to read. Like if I'm standing in front of 1,000 people and I want to give, whatever, opening commentary, if I need to say specific things and I need to be, accurate, then I might read from a script. If I have a general topic that I want to talk to, it's preparing and thinking about that topic, but just speaking freely on that topic without having to read something. But yeah, it does take time and patience and practice and persistence to become a public speaker. I will say though, I see these clips from, back, for some of these politicians. If you really like the public speaking, maybe politics is your line of work. But they seem to be great public speakers even in college when you find these clips of them talking and asking questions. And so some of it's natural ability, but it's not to say that you can't work at it and practice and become a good public speaker. But yeah, that's
You
something.
know, when you were talking, Angela, it reminded me of sixth grade, and this wasn't even my own experience. I was just in the audience. So I remember we were in
Yeah.
English class, and we actually had to do presentations as well. But I think I did okay. But then there was this one girl. Oh my gosh, I felt so bad for her. She got up in front of everybody and froze, and then she started to cry. And I just remember thinking, oh man, poor girl. So hopefully you weren't reduced to tears that back in fourth grade when you had to give your presentation, you just froze and try to muddle through it as best you could.
Well, it is one of those things that it is apparently, like one of the major fears people have. And even in de depending on even the setting itself, unfortunately. Like I was just watching Tom Brady talk about his new role as the Delta. He's like going to be this leadership advocate for Delta now. And he was sitting next to like the Delta CEO, and they were getting questioned on television. And Tom Brady sounded a little nervous. And I think it's in part because this was different for him. He does press conferences after a game. He's talking about football. And this is a new setting for him. He's talking about a different topic. He's in a different setting, interviewed on television. And he sounded, he did fine, but no one's perfect. Everyone has their different strengths, and I think he did a great job, but he sounded a little nervous. And so if Tom Brady can sound a little nervous, it's okay. You'll do fine when you're public speaking.
Indeed,
So
100%. Well, speaking of nerves, do you ever get nervous before you give presentations? And if so, how do you deal with those nerves?
not as much anymore, and in part because I'd say sometimes you have to think about and maybe in just life, think about the worst case scenario, like what could happen, right? Like if I don't do a great job in this lecture or whatever it might be, people don't care. It's fine. You share what you can, do your best. But don't worry about it. And everyone in the audience wants you to do your best as well. They're there supporting you. And so your own worst enemy when you're up there talking is yourself. And if you go into it with a positive attitude that you want to provide, a good lecture or whatever presentation, think you got to think positively. And if you go in with that type of attitude, you'll do just fine. A self-defeating attitude, like I'm gonna screw up, I'm gonna stutter. You gotta get those negative thoughts out of your head, and not at least just not putting attention to them. And even go in thinking about having fun with it, because if it's a topic that you do enjoy, and hopefully it's a topic you might enjoy or at least have some knowledge in, then use it as an opportunity to teach others something that you're feeling, passionate about or something that you care about.
Yeah,
So.
I 100% agree with you, Angelo, when it comes to giving presentations. And I can recall even some presentations that I looked at where that wasn't the case. Those are always kind of interesting when you see a presenter giving a presentation, the people in the audience, they're well, at least some of them, they don't want to see you do well. I mean, I've seen some conferences where, especially the academic ones, where you have competing labs. It there and you have one person giving a presentation and someone from a competing lab is asking them, just hitting them with question after question, trying to discredit them. And I remember one time, this was when I was still in school, and the presenter was actually one of my professors, and he was just turning beet red. I half expected him to eventually say, you know what, you need to meet me outside. You got to catch these hands real quick. People get it's like, you ain't gonna disrespect me on this damn podium, you know what I mean?
I suppose in any way, it's good to direct that energy, whether it be in a setting where maybe it's a little bit more contentious and competitive, maybe you direct that energy to perform even better. Like, oh man, they're out to get me. I'm gonna try to I'll show them. That could be beneficial. And ironically, sometimes if you got a group of people that really want you to do well and they're all smiling, like, I hope you really give, this best man speech, I hope this really good works out well, that may make you even more nervous about it.
Yeah, like, I can't screw this up. Oh, man. They got this on video. Yeah, this has been a great conversation. Thank you so much for being a guest, Angelo. How can people get in
Yeah.
touch with you?
So if you go to vtol.org, VTOL.org, O-R-G, that's our main website. But you can, and my phone number is probably on there. If you go to the Meet the Team, but if you want to get in touch with me, my email is on there. It's A Collins at vtol.org, ACOLLINS at vtol.org as well.
Excellent.
I'm always looking to talk to people and teach them about vertical flight and anything they want to talk about.
Great. Well, everyone, that marks the end of another edition of Teach the Geek Interviews. My name is Neil Thompson. I'm the founder of Teach the Geek. I work with technical professionals so they can present more effectively, especially in front of non-technical audiences. And you can learn more about that at teachthegeek.com. Again, that's teachthegeek.com. Until next time, take care and stay safe. Thanks, Angelo.
Thanks.
Well, everyone, that marks another episode in the can. I hope you enjoyed it. If you like these episodes and want to support Teach the Geek, please subscribe, share, and like on any of your favorite podcast platforms. Or on all of them. Also, if you prefer to watch the episodes, head on over to the YouTube channel at youtube.teachthegeek.com. Until next time.